It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Certified election results confirm that then-President Donald Trump lost Pennsylvania to Joe Biden in November by 80,000 votes. But Republican State Senator Doug Mastriano has launched an effort for what he calls a forensic investigation of Pennsylvania's election results. The Associated Press's Mark Levy has been reporting on this story, and he's been covering state politics for many years. Welcome back to the program, Mark.
Thank you for having me.
There have been recounts that have confirmed Joe Biden's victory in Pennsylvania. The courts have debunked claims of a stolen election, as did Trump's own attorney general. So what is the state senator hoping to gain from this?
Well, he says that this will provide transparency and resolve any concerns over the 2020 election. These concerns, of course, are primarily stemming from Donald Trump saying that the election was rigged and stolen from him.
Is he saying that it's his constituents that have concerns as well?
Yes, certainly a number of Republican lawmakers around the state are hearing it loud from their constituents that they don't trust the election result. And public polling bears that out, that there are a lot of Republicans, a lot of Trump voters who don't believe that the election was real and that Democrat Joe Biden really beat Donald Trump in Pennsylvania.
Is Mastriano maybe also hoping for Trump's endorsement, maybe in a bid for higher office, which, as you referenced, would likely weigh heavily among loyal Trump supporters in Pennsylvania?
Sure. So there's a couple things going on here. One is that Doug Mastriano has been talking for quite a while now about possibly running for governor. He's also fundraising off of it. Doug Mastriano is fundraising off this, as is the state Republican Party.
So, Mark, Senator Mastriano originally targeted three counties, Philadelphia, York, and Tioga. Why those three?
He has talked about those three counties as being fair and balanced and from a partisan standpoint. So you have two Republican-controlled counties and then Philadelphia, which is the state's largest city and a big Democratic city where four and five registered voters are Democrats. York is a heavily populated county. It's in the top 10 in the state. Tioga is a very small rural county, not many people there. It's on the northern border. Mastriano has a part of York County he represents, and Tioga County is in the district of Chris Dush, a state senator who is aligned philosophically with Doug Mastriano on this audit and went to see the Arizona audit with them.
And a note, Donald Trump actually did better in Philadelphia in 2020 than he did in 2016 when he won the state. But Mark, you're also reporting that Pennsylvania's top election official, the acting Secretary of State, has decertified the voting machines of Fulton County. Why?
This is sort of separate but related. Back in December, Fulton County has said that it was being contacted by Republican lawmakers, including Mastriano, about submitting to a forensic audit, submitting its machines. And so it did it, and it didn't really come out until months later that it had done that. It allowed a software company that is not certified to test voting machines to go in and take images of hard drives and USB drives. What Veronica DeGraffenried, the acting Secretary of State, is saying is that, look, counties have a legal obligation to maintain proper chain of custody control over voting machines to make sure that their anti-tampering protections aren't compromised. And because this was done in the manner that was, she's saying it wasn't transparent, she's saying it wasn't bipartisan. She didn't say this, but Wake TSI is not, as far as I can tell, a certified lab. She says that they have no experience with election equipment. And so she is ordering these voting machines to be decertified.
And therefore, Fulton County is going to have to get new voting machines in time for November.
Presumably, yeah. These were leased last fall. They had to lease different ones for May while the state was looking into this matter. Unless they somehow successfully challenge this action, I don't know what's possible here. and we haven't heard back from Fulton County. They have maintained in our conversations with them that, you know, this was all above board and that nothing was wrong and that chain of custody was not compromised.
So has Senator Mastriano said who would do this forensic audit and who would pay for it?
No. So there are a lot of questions that he's left unanswered. The three I keep pointing to out in my stories are that he hasn't said how it would be funded. He hasn't said who would do all this work. And he hasn't said where all this equipment would be stored securely. I mean, it is an impressive amount of documents and equipment that he's asking for.
From the Republicans you spoke with for your stories, this seems to be a divisive issue. What did former GOP Congressman Charlie Dent tell you?
He's extremely worried about it. He thinks it's undermining democratic institutions. He thinks it's undermining confidence in elections, and he thinks it'll be bad for the state Republican Party. He's still a Republican. You know, there are a lot of Republicans who are quiet about it right now who hate this idea. They think it's pointless, but they're not willing to speak up because from all appearances, most Republican voters might be on board with this.
What is the next step? Is it up to Mastriano or what?
So in his letter, he gave the counties a timeline until July 31st to respond in writing with a plan to comply and then to kind of lay out a timeline in that letter of how they would provide this information. After July 31st, assuming that Tioga and York counties don't change their minds and Philadelphia is not going to comply, it'll be up to Mastriano to assemble his committee and hold a vote of the committee. That is, if he goes through with this subpoena, there are questions from Senate Democrats whether his committee legally has any jurisdiction over elections. So perhaps Senate Republicans would try to switch this to a different committee with perhaps more overlap with local governments or elections. Doug Mastriano chairs the Intergovernmental Operations Committee, which historically has never dealt with election matters. It's always dealt with internal intergovernmental regulatory matters.
Reporter Mark Levy covers government and state politics for the Associated Press. Mark, as always, thanks so much for your reporting and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Laura Satsui. Last week, those collecting unemployment benefits in Pennsylvania had to start fulfilling a work search requirement. The state dropped this requirement in light of the pandemic. For some, however, simply being unemployed creates other challenges that can make it even harder to find a new job. With us is Sarah Damaski, an associate professor of sociology and labor and unemployment relations at Pennsylvania State University. Her recently published book, The Tolls of Uncertainty, examines this very problem. Sarah, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So for this book, you interviewed 100 people throughout the state starting in 2013, so pre-pandemic. And you categorized them by gender, men and women, and as working or middle class, and found in some ways the assumptions that I or others have about who might land on their feet after unemployment and who might continue to experience hardship is true.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the privilege that people have or the advantages that people have going into unemployment don't go away. I mean, everyone finds unemployment to be a difficult time in their lives, but some people have many more tools that let them go through that experience and get through it to the other side with fewer scratches and scars than others do. And what I found was that middle-class men were much more likely to receive severances, for example, than all of the women and then the working-class men that I met. And first of all, this meant that they described feeling very differently about their job loss. The women and the working class men described feeling angry. Some talked about being bitter or pissed. And the middle class men really didn't have those feelings.
And you point out being unemployed doesn't just mean you've lost your job, you've lost wages, and are now getting unemployment, which is often quite a bit less than what you might have been making. There's a whole other host of difficulties, especially for women. Can you explain some of you know, the particular challenges that come up in unemployment?
If you are lucky and you qualify for unemployment benefits, which not everyone who loses a job does, you are roughly receiving about half of the wages you had previously earned. And this is if you're living in Pennsylvania, because in Pennsylvania, we're on the generous side, as it were. Some states give quite a bit less than that. Making do on half of what you were making before can make people's budgets really tight. But then people also lose their health insurance, because most people get their health insurance through their work if they receive health insurance. And so health insurance gets lost. And then the other thing that we see that women face that is much less likely for men is that they are expected to do more around the house after they lose a job. And so this creates less of an ability to search for a job because you're now providing care. And men don't face that challenge. There is very little expectation when men leave work due to unemployment that they will start providing child care full time.
You interviewed these people, as I said, in 2013, so long before a pandemic was even on our minds, and also before, you know, all of the job loss that we saw. However, you know, in the last year, Pennsylvania and other states enacted measures that seem to really support those who are unemployed, and measures that seem to align with policy changes that you suggest would be really beneficial. But now that we're kind of returning to quote-unquote normal, some of those extra benefits are rolling back. Do you think overall the policies and the will to enact better policies are moving in the right direction, though, when it comes to supporting people who are unemployed?
I would love for us to hold on to the generosity that we had when we first enacted the CARES Act and when President Biden extended it in March. When we compare the people who are unemployed and had access to the CARES Act supplemental benefits and those who did not, that those who had access were much less likely to experience material hardship than those who didn't have access to the supplemental benefits, which I think suggests to us that the benefits were very important, right? The supplemental benefits were necessary to prevent that economic hardship. And so I think, one, it teaches us that when we are more generous, we are less likely to allow people to be thrown into poverty by unemployment. And that's a really important thing for us to pause and take a look at that and say, this is why unemployment insurance came about in the first place, right? Because FDR and Francis Perkins looked at the horror of the Great Depression and said, never again. So that's the first. The second is that there is fairly good evidence from this past year that people are returning to work once they can, once they can find a job that matches their skill set. And that suggests when we give people the time and the resources they need to find work, that they will find work. And combined, this suggests that we need to be more generous. But I'm not sure if we have the political will to implement that evidence.
Finally, Sarah, so in the book, you followed up with as many of your interviewees as you could find a year later. Here now in 2021, 2020, have you still kept up with any of them? Do you know how any of them are doing?
I do have my email open. They know that they're always welcome to reach out to me. I have not reached back out to them at this point, but I think we can imagine how many of them are doing. I think the ones who had that kind of chronic unemployment that I detail in the book, I imagine that many of them struggled this past year. And I imagine that there are many like Tracy, or many Tracys out there, right? Tracy is a waitress who I describe in the book, who took a chance at a factory job because it was going to pay a better wage, and she lost it after not even having been at the factory a year. And so I think that we can imagine that for Tracy and people like her, that because she had found work as a waitress again. I can't imagine that this was an easy year for her, because we can imagine that the place where she, the restaurant where she had found a job, did not stay open. And since it was a mom and pop shop, I can't imagine they were able to keep her on. I think these were difficult times for many of them.
Sarah Damaski is an associate professor at Pennsylvania State University and author of the book, The Tolls of Uncertainty. Sarah, thanks for writing this book and for your time.
Thanks so much.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. For the first time in 20 months, live competitive running is back on the streets of Pittsburgh. The Fleet Feet Liberty Mile, the fastest, shortest run, returns Friday evening at 6. Joining us now is Troy Schooley, CEO of P3R, which organizes and owns several races, including the Pittsburgh Marathon and the Liberty Mile. Troy, the last two marathons were run virtually, as was last year's Liberty Mile and the 10-miler. As the organizer, how does it feel to have live racing again?
Well, first off, good morning, Kevin. Thanks for having me on. It's like Christmas morning here in the office this week. It's been a great feeling to, you know, feel that live start line again on Friday night for the Fleet Feet Liberty Mile. As you mentioned, 20 months is a long time, but, you know, we've been able to inspire a lot of people to continue moving throughout COVID, and we're, you know, excited to welcome them back Friday night downtown Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm. How many participants have signed up to this point?
So right now, Kevin, we're at 1,300, which is a record. The Fleet Feet Liberty Mile has been around for 10 years, and the previous record was 1,196. So we have exceeded that, and we continue adding. This week's been a great week for registration. I think people are just excited to get back to a live start line.
Mm-hmm. So it's Christmas morning for you and your colleagues, but what about the participants, those running, whether they're the pros or the recreational runners, what are you hearing from them about how they're feeling?
Oh, they're super excited. You know, everybody, you know, continue to move with us virtually, but it's really not the same as that live start line feeling, the jitters that you have as you kind of approach the start line and want to reach your goal. Whatever your goal is that day or that night, you know, the response, you know, seeing people around has just been, I can't wait to see you guys on Friday night. So it's been great to, you know, hearing the runners want to get back to a live start line.
In normal times, people would line Penn and Liberty Avenues after work to watch, cheer on the runners. But still, so many people are working remotely, not as many downtown as usual. So what are you expecting as far as those lining the streets Friday evening?
You know what, Kevin? I think the spectators are going to come out in full force on Friday night. You know, being at a record number year with 1,300 participants, the great thing about the race is they run their race, and then they get to watch the elites, some of the fastest in the country, compete for, you know, almost a $30,000 prize purse. So I think that the spectators are going to be out in full force. I think it's going to be a super exciting night. The weather looks great for really a fast event. So we're excited, not just for the runners, but to, you know, to welcome all the spectators back as well.
Mm-hmm. The in-person course starts at about 6th and Penn, downtown, heads east to 11th Street, and then down the stretch on Liberty and ends up around 6th and Liberty. For those not comfortable, though, can they still run the Liberty Mile virtually?
Absolutely. Yeah, we have people from around the country that have signed up to continue to run virtually. They get a shirt and a medal. Maybe they're not comfortable coming to a start line, or maybe they're just not able to come into town, but they want to be part of the Fleet Feet Liberty Mile. So, you know, we've had a lot of people, like I said, from around the country register virtually, and they're going to be running, whether it's, you know, today or tomorrow or this weekend, they'll get their mile in and continue to move with us.
Mm-hmm. So how are you going to keep people safe?
Yeah, so at the start line this year, we're going to have masks just because, you know, Kevin, at a start line, there's 500, 600 people in each heat kind of shoulder to shoulder for an extended period. So we're going to have masks at the start line. They're able to take them off once the horn goes off. And at the finish line, it's going to be a little bit of a different finish line shoot. We're going to try to get them out quicker, so there's not really standing around, so they'll be able to collect their bags and their medals and their bananas and water and just kind of move out the chute. So we feel that, you know, working with UPMC, we have a really safe approach to the event this year. And obviously being able to get back to a live event is just super exciting to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. We only have about a minute left. During the pandemic, people went outside. Do you think that brought more people into outdoor exercise, whether it's running or hiking or some other activity?
Absolutely. You know, I think we're seeing a running boom. I think we're going to see a running boom the way our registrations are going right now. And what I tell people is I think that when people got outside at the beginning of COVID, they were walking around their neighborhoods or their local parks, and that walk probably turned into a jog. And for some, that jog turned into a run. So over 20% of our participants Friday night are brand new to our events, which I feel is a great, looking forward in this world of running, getting people out just to move. And they don't need to be fast at all. We just want them out moving. So it's an exciting time to be, you know, associated with P3R and the running community in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm. And in our last minute, you said this increase of people. For someone that hasn't ever run a race before, what are they missing out on?
Just the excitement and the experience. You know, people, I think, get discouraged because maybe they're not fast enough or maybe they've never been to one. But once they come and kind of get that bug of how exciting it was and what the experience was that they you know, completed a goal and they did it with their friends and family and probably met some new people along the way. So we want to encourage everybody to come to a live start line just to feel that experience and set whatever your goal is to be able to complete it.
Troy Schooley is the CEO of P3R, which organizes and owns several races, including the Pittsburgh Marathon and the Liberty Mile, which is Friday evening starting at 6. Troy, thanks so much for your time and good luck.
Thanks, Kevin. I'll see you Friday night.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Rebecca Reese, Owen Trainer, Laura Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.